night had exhaustion compelled him to accept that Melissa probably wasn't going to call him and certainly wasn't going to come and see him. That he was now psychically capable neither of breaking the rules of the game he'd invented nor of quitting the game before he'd achieved its object. And it was clear to him that the rules permitted only genuine sharp kicks, prohibited, in particular, working his foot under the padded mailer and advancing it with any sort of pushing or lofting motion. And so he was obliged to kick his Christmas package from Denise with escalating savagery until it tore open and spilled its ground newsprint stuffing, and he succeeded in catching its ripped sheathing with the toe of his boot and launching the gift in a long, clean arc that landed it one step shy of the second floor. From there, however, the mailer refused to be budged up over the lip of the final step. Chip trampled and kicked and shredded the mailer with his heels. Inside was a mess of red paper and green silk. He broke his own rule and scraped the mess up over the last step, kicked it down the hall, and left it by his bed while he went down for the other boxes. These, too, he pretty well destroyed before he developed a method of bouncing them off a low step and then, while they were airborne, punting them all the way upstairs. When he punted the box from Gary, it exploded in a cloud of white styrofoam saucers. A bubble-wrapped bottle fell out and rolled down the stairs. It was a bottle of vintage Californian port. Chip carried it up to his bed and worked out a rhythm whereby he swallowed one large mouthful of port for each gift that he succeeded in unwrapping. From his mother, who was under the impression that he still hung a stocking by his fireplace, he'd received a box marked stocking stuffers, containing small, individually wrapped items. A package of cough drops, a miniature second-grade school photo of himself in a tarnished brass frame, plastic bottles of shampoo and conditioner and hand lotion from a Hong Kong hotel where Enid and Alfred had stayed en route to China 11 years earlier, and two carved wooden elves with sentimentally exaggerated smiles and loops of silver string that penetrated their little craniums so they could be hung from a tree. For placement under this presumptive tree, Enid had sent a second box of larger gifts wrapped in Santa-faced red paper. An asparagus steamer, three pairs of white jockey underwear, a jumbo candy cane, and two calico throw pillows. From Gary and his wife, in addition to the port, Chip received a clever vacuum pump system for preserving leftover wine from oxidation, as if leftover wine were a problem Chip had ever had. From Denise, to whom he'd given the selected letters of André Gide, after erasing from the flyleaf the evidence that he'd paid $1 for this particularly tone-deaf translation, he received a beautiful lime-green silk shirt. And from his father, $100 check, with the handwritten instruction to buy himself something he liked. Except for the shirt, which he'd worn, and the check, which he'd cashed, and the bottle of port, which he'd killed in bed on Christmas night, the gifts from his family were still on the floor of his bedroom. Stuffing from Denise's mailer had drifted into the kitchen and mixed with splashed dishwater to form a mud that he'd tracked all over. Flocks of sheep-white styrofoam pebbles had collected in sheltered places. It was nearly 10:30 in the Midwest. "Hello, Dad. Happy 75th. Things are going well here. How are things in St. Jude?" Chip felt he couldn't make the call without some kind of pick-me-up or treat. Some kind of energizer. But TV caused him such critical and political anguish that he could no longer watch even cartoons without smoking cigarettes. And he now had a lung-sized region of pain in his chest, and there was no intoxicant of any sort in his house, not even cooking sherry, not even cough syrup. And after the labor of taking his pleasure with the chaise, his endorphins had gone home to the four corners of his brain like war-weary troops, so spent by the demands he'd made of them in the last 5 weeks that nothing, except possibly Melissa in the flesh, could marshal them again. He needed a little morale booster, a little pick-me-up. But he had nothing better than the month-old Times, and he felt that he'd circled quite enough uppercase M's for one day. He could circle no more. He went to his dining table and confirmed the absence of dregs in the wine bottles on it. He'd used the last $220 of credit on his Visa card to buy 8 bottles of a rather tasty Fronsac, and on Saturday night he'd thrown one last dinner party to rally his supporters on the faculty. A few years ago, after Dee's drama department had fired a popular young professor, Kali Lopez, for having claimed to have a degree she didn't have, outraged students and junior faculty had organized boycotts and candlelight vigils that had forced the college not only to rehire Lopez, but to promote her to a full professor. Granted, Chip was neither a lesbian nor a Filipina, as Lopez was, but he'd taught theory of feminism, and he had a 100% voting record with the queer bloc, and he routinely packed his syllabi with non-Western writers, and all he'd really done in Room 23 of the Comfort Valley Lodge was put into practice certain theories, the myth of authorship, the resistant consumerism of transgressive sexual transactions that the college had hired him to teach. Unfortunately, the theories sounded somewhat lame when he wasn't lecturing to impressionable adolescents. Of the 8 colleagues who'd accepted his invitation for dinner on Saturday, only 4 had shown up. And despite his efforts to steer the conversation around to his predicament, the only collective action his friends had taken on his behalf had been to serenade him as they killed the 8th bottle of wine with an a cappella rendition of Non, je ne regrette rien. He hadn't had the strength to clear the table in the intervening days. He considered the blackened red leaf lettuce, the skin of congealed grease on an uneaten lamb chop, the mess of corks and ashes. The shame and disorder in his house were like the shame and disorder in his head. Kali Lopez was now the college's acting provost, Jim Levitin's replacement.
Tell me about your relationship with your student, Melissa Paquette.
My former student?
Your former student.
I'm friendly with her. We've had dinner. I spent some time with her at the beginning of Thanksgiving break. She's a brilliant student.
Did you give Melissa any help with a paper she wrote last week for Vendla O'Fallon?
We talked about the paper in a general way. She had some areas of confusion that I was able to help her clear up.
Is your relationship with her sexual?
No.
Chip, what I think we'll do is suspend you with pay until we can have a full hearing. That's what we'll do. We'll have a hearing early next week, and in the meantime you should probably get a lawyer and talk to your union rep. I also have to insist that you not speak to Melissa Paquette.
What does she say? That I wrote that paper?
Melissa violated the honor code by handing in work that was not her own. She's facing a one-semester suspension, but we understand that there are mitigating factors. For example, your grossly inappropriate sexual relationship with her.
That's what she says?
My personal advice, Chip, is resign now.
That's what she says?
You have no chance.
The snow melt was raining down harder on his patio. He lit a cigarette on the front burner of his stove, took 2 painful drags, and pressed the coal into the palm of his hand. He groaned through clenched teeth and opened his freezer and put his palm to its floor and stood for a minute smelling flesh smoke. Then, holding an ice cube, he went to the phone and dialed the ancient area code, the ancient number. While the phone rang in St. Jude, he planted a foot on the section of Times in his trash and mashed it down deeper, got it out of sight.
"Oh, Chip," Enid cried. "He's already gone to bed."
"Don't wake him," Chip said. "Just tell him..." But Enid set the phone down and shouted, "Al! Al!" at volumes that diminished as she moved farther from the phone and up the stairs toward the bedrooms. Chip heard her shout, "It's Chip!" He heard their upstairs extension click into action. He heard Enid instructing Alfred, "Don't just say hello and hang up. Visit with him a little." There was a rustling transfer of the receiver.
"Yes,"
Alfred said.
"Hey, Dad, happy birthday," Chip said.
"Yes,"
Alfred said again in exactly the same flat voice.
"I'm sorry to call so late. I was not asleep,"
Alfred said.
"I was afraid I woke you up."
"Yes."
"Well, so, happy 75th.
"Yes."
Chip hoped that Enid was motoring back down to the kitchen as fast as she could, ailing hip and all, to bail him out.
"I guess you're tired and it's late," he said. "We don't have to talk." "Thank you for the call," Alfred said.
Enid was back on the line.
"I'm going to finish these dishes," she said. "We had a party here tonight. Al, tell Chip about the party we had. I'm getting off the phone now."
She hung up. Chip said,
"You had a party?"
"Yes.
The Roots were here for dinner and bridge."
"Did you have a cake?"
"Your mother made a cake."
The cigarette had made a hole in Chip's body through which he felt painful harms could enter and vital factors painfully escape. Melting ice was leaking through his fingers.
"How was the bridge?"
"My typical terrible cards."
"That doesn't seem fair on your birthday."
"I imagine," Alfred said, "that you are gearing up for another semester."
"Right, right. Although, actually not. Actually, I'm deciding not to teach at all this semester."
"I didn't hear."
Chip raised his voice.
"I said I've decided not to teach this semester. I'm going to take the semester off and work on my writing."
"My recollection is that you are due for tenure soon."
"Right, in April. It seems to me that a person hoping to be offered tenure would be advised to stay and teach."
"Right. If they see you working hard, they will have no reason not to offer you tenure."
"Right. Right,"
Chip nodded. "At the same time, I have to prepare for the possibility that I won't get it, and I've got a very attractive offer from a Hollywood producer, a college friend of Denise's who produces movies, potentially very lucrative."
"A great worker is almost impossible to fire," Alfred said.
"The process can get very political, though. I have to have alternatives."
"As you wish," Alfred said. "However, I've found that it's usually best to choose one plan and stick with it. If you don't succeed here, you can always do something else, but you've worked many years to reach this point. One more semester's hard work won't hurt you."
"Right."
"You can relax when you have tenure. Then you're safe."
"Right."
"Well, thank you for the call."
"Right. Happy birthday, Dad."
Chip dropped the phone, left the kitchen and took a Fronsac bottle by the neck and brought its body down hard on the edge of his dining table. He broke a second bottle. The remaining six he smashed two at a time, a neck in each fist. Anger carried him through the difficult weeks that followed. He borrowed $10,000 from Denise and hired a lawyer to threaten to sue D. College for wrongful termination of his contract. This was a waste of money, but it felt good. He went to New York and ponied up $4,000 in fees and deposits for a sublet on 9th Street. He bought leather clothes and had his ears pierced. He borrowed more money from Denise and reconnected with a college friend who edited the Warren Street Journal. He conceived revenge in the form of a screenplay that would expose the narcissism and treachery of Melissa Paquette and the hypocrisy of his colleagues. He wanted the people who'd hurt him to see the movie, recognize themselves, and suffer. He flirted with Julia Vrace and asked her on a date, and soon he was spending $200 or $300 a week to feed an entertainer. He borrowed more money from Denise. He hung cigarettes on his lower lip and banged out a draft of a script. Julia, in the back seat of cabs, pressed her face against his chest and clutched his collar. He tipped waiters and cabbies 30% and 40%. He quoted Shakespeare and Byron in funny contexts. He borrowed more money from Denise and decided that she was right, that getting fired was the best thing that had ever happened to him. He wasn't so naive, of course, as to take Eden Procuro's professional effusions at face value. But the more he saw of Eden socially, the more confident he became that his script would get a sympathetic reading. For one thing, Eden was like a mother to Julia. She was only 5 years older, but she'd undertaken a wholesale recalibration and improvement of her personal assistant.
although Chip never quite shook the feeling that Eden was hoping to cast someone else in the role of Julia's love interest. She habitually referred to Chip as Julia's escort, not her boyfriend, and when she talked about Julia's untapped potential and her lack of confidence, he suspected that mate selection was one area in which she hoped to see improvement in Julia. Julia assured him that Eden thought he was really dear and extremely smart. Certainly, Eden's husband, Doug O'Brien, was on his side. Doug was a mergers and acquisitions specialist at Bragg, Neuter & Spey. He'd set Chip up with a flex-time proofreading job and had seen to it that Chip was paid the top hourly wage. Whenever Chip tried to thank him for this favor, Doug made shawing motions with his hand. "You're the man with the Ph.D.," he said. "That book of yours is scary, smart stuff." Chip had soon become a frequent guest at the O'Brien Procuro's dinner parties in Tribeca and their weekend house parties in Quag. Drinking their liquor and eating their catered food, he had a foretaste of a success 100 times sweeter than tenure. He felt that he was really living. Then one night, Julia sat him down and said there was an important fact that she hadn't mentioned earlier, and would he promise not to be too mad at her? The important fact was that she sort of had a husband. The deputy prime minister of Lithuania, a small Baltic country, was a man named Gitanas Misevičius. Well, the fact was that Julia had married him a couple of years ago, and she hoped Chip wouldn't be too mad at her. Her problem with men, she said, was that she'd grown up without. Her father was a manic, depressive boat salesman whom she remembered meeting once and wished she'd never met at all. Her mother, a cosmetics company executive, had fobbed Julia off on her own mother, who'd enrolled her in a Catholic girls' school. Julia's first significant experience with men was at college. Then she moved to New York and embarked on the long process of sleeping with every dishonest, casually sadistic, terminally uncommitted, really gorgeous guy in the borough of Manhattan. By the age of 28, she had little to feel good about except her looks, her apartment, and her steady job, which mainly consisted, however, of answering the phone. So when she met Gitanas at a club and Gitanas took her seriously, and by produced an actual, not small, diamond in a white-gold setting and seemed to love her, and the guy was, after all, an honest-to-God ambassador to the United Nations, she'd gone and heard him do his Baltic thundering at the General Assembly. She did her level best to repay his kindness. She was as agreeable as humanly possible. She refused to disappoint Gitanas, even though, in hindsight, it probably would have been better to disappoint him. Gitanas was quite a bit older and fairly attentive in bed, not like Chip, Julia hastened to say, but not, you know, terrible. And he seemed to know what he was doing with the marriage thing, and so one day she went to City Hall with him. She might even have gone by Mrs. Misevičius if it had sounded less idiotic. Once she was married, she realized that the marble floors and black lacquer furniture and heavy modern smoked glass fixtures of the ambassador's apartment on the East River weren't as entertainingly campy as she'd thought. They were more like unbearably depressing. She made Gitanas sell the place, the chief of the Paraguayan delegation was delighted to get it, and buy a smaller, nicer place on Hudson Street near some good clubs. She found a competent hairstylist for Gitanas and taught him how to pick out clothes with natural fibers. Things seemed to be going great. But somewhere she and Gitanas must have misunderstood each other because when his party, the VIPPPAKJRIINPB17, the one true party unswervingly dedicated to the revanchist ideals of Kazimieras Yaramaitis and the independent plebiscite of April 17, lost the September election, and recalled him to Vilnius to join the parliamentary opposition, he took it for granted that Julia would come along with him. And Julia understood the concept of one flesh, wife cleaving to husband and so forth. But Gitanas, in his descriptions of post-Soviet Vilnius, had painted a picture of chronic coal and electricity shortages, freezing drizzles, drive-by shootings, and heavy dietary reliance on horse meat. And so she did a really terrible thing to Gitanas, definitely the worst thing she'd ever done to anybody. She agreed to go and live in Vilnius, and she sort of got on the plane with Gitanas and sat down in first class, and then
sneaked off the plane and sort of changed their home phone number and had Eden tell Gitanas when he called that she had disappeared. 6 months later, Gitanas returned to New York for a weekend and made Julia feel really, really guilty. And yes, no argument, she'd disgraced herself. But Gitanas proceeded to call her certain rough names, and he slapped her pretty hard. The upshot of which was that they couldn't be together anymore, but she continued to use their apartment on Hudson Street in exchange for staying married in case Gitanas needed quick asylum in the United States, because apparently things were going from bad to worse in Lithuania. Anyway, that was the story of her and Gitanas, and she hoped that Chip wouldn't be too mad at her. And Chip was not. Indeed, at first, he not only didn't mind that Julie was married, he adored the fact. He was fascinated by her rings. He talked her into wearing them in bed. Down at the offices of the Warren Street Journal, where he sometimes felt insufficiently transgressive, as if his innermost self were still a nice Midwestern boy, he took pleasure in alluding to the European statesman he was cuckolding. In his doctoral thesis, Doubtful It Stood, Anxieties of the Phallus in Tudor Drama, he'd written extensively about cuckolds, and under the cloak of his reproving modern scholarship, he'd been excited by the idea of marriage as a property right, of adultery as theft. Before long, though, the thrill of poaching on the diplomat's preserve gave way to bourgeois fantasies in which Chip himself was Julia's husband, her lord, her liege. He became spasmodically jealous of Gitanas Misevičius, who, though Lithuanian and a slapper, was a successful politician whose name Julia now pronounced with guilt and wistfulness. On New Year's Eve, Chip asked her point-blank if she ever thought about divorce. She replied that she liked her apartment, can't beat the rent, and she didn't want to look for another one right now. After New Year's, Chip returned to his rough draft of The Academy Purple, which he'd completed in a euphoric 20-page blaze of keyboard pounding and discovered that it had a lot of problems. It looked, in fact, like incoherent hackwork. During the month that he'd spent expensively celebrating its completion, he'd imagined that he could remove certain hackneyed plot elements. The conspiracy, the car crash, the evil lesbians, and still tell a good story. Without these hackneyed plot elements, however, he seemed to have no story at all. In order to salvage his artistic and intellectual ambitions, he added a long theoretical opening monologue. But this monologue was so unreadable that every time he turned on his computer, he had to go and tinker with it. Soon he was spending the bulk of each work session compulsively honing the monologue. And when he despaired of shortening it any further without sacrificing important thematic material, he started fussing with the margins and hyphenation to make the monologue end at the bottom of page 6 rather than the top of page 7. He replaced the word continue with go on to save 3 spaces, thus allowing the word transactions to be hyphenated after the second T, which triggered a whole cascade of longer lines and more efficient hyphenations. Then he decided that go on had the wrong rhythm and that transactions should not be hyphenated under any circumstances, and so he scoured the text for other longish words to replace with shorter synonyms, all the while struggling to believe that stars and producers in Prada jackets would enjoy reading 6 pages, but not 7, of turgid academic theorizing. Once, when he was a boy, there was a total eclipse of the sun in the Midwest, and a girl in one of the pokey towns across the river from St. Jude had sat outside and, in defiance of myriad warnings, studied the dwindling crescent of the sun until her retinas combusted. It didn't hurt at all, the blinded girl had told the St. Jude Chronicle. It felt like nothing. Each day that Chip spent grooming the corpse of a dramatically dead monologue was a day in which his rent and food and entertainment expenses were paid for in large part with his little sister's money. And yet as long as the money lasted, his pain was not acute. One day led to another. He rarely got out of bed before noon. He enjoyed his food and his wine. He dressed well enough to persuade himself that he was not a quivering gelatinous mess, and he managed on 4 out of 5 evenings to hide the worst of his anxiety and foreboding and enjoy himself with Julia. Because the sum he owed Denise was large in comparison to his proofreading wage, but small by Hollywood standards. He worked less and less at Bragg, Neuter, and Spey. His only real complaint was with his health. On a summer day, when his work session consisted of rereading Act One, being struck afresh by its irredeemable badness, and hurrying outside to get some air, he might walk down Broadway and sit on a bench at Battery Park City, and let the breeze off the Hudson flow under his collar, and listen to the ceaseless foot-foot of copter traffic and the distant shouts of millionaire Tribeca toddlers, and be overcome with guilt. To be so vigorous and healthy, and yet so nothing, neither taking advantage of his good night's sleep and his successful avoidance of a cold to get some work done, nor yet fully entering into the vacation spirit, and flirting with strangers, and knocking back margaritas. It would have been better, he thought, to do his getting sick and dying now, while he was failing, and save his health and vitality for some later date when, unimaginable though the prospect was, he would perhaps no longer be failing. Of all the things he was wasting, Denise's money, Julia's goodwill, his own abilities and education, the opportunities afforded by the longest sustained economic boom in American history, his sheer physical well-being, there in the sunlight by the river, hurt the worst. He ran out of money on a Friday in July. Facing a weekend with Julia, who could cost him $15 at a cinema refreshments counter, he purged the Marxists from his bookshelves and took them to the Strand in 2 extremely heavy bags. The books were in their original jackets and had an aggregate list price of $3,900. A buyer at the Strand appraised them casually and delivered his verdict. 65. Chip laughed in a breathy way, willing himself not to argue, but his UK edition of Jürgen Habermas's Reason and the Rationalization of Society, which he'd found too difficult to read, let alone annotate, was in mint condition and had cost him £95. He couldn't help pointing this out by way of example.
"Try somewhere else, if you like," the buyer said, his hand hesitating above the cash register.
"No, no, you're right," Chip said. 65 is great."
It was pathetically obvious that he'd believed his books would fetch him hundreds of dollars. He turned away from their reproachful spines, remembering how each of them had called out in a bookstore with a promise of a radical critique of late capitalist society, and how happy he'd been to take them home. But Jürgen Habermas didn't have Julia's long, cool pear-tree limbs. Theodor Adorno didn't have Julia's grapey smell of lecherous pliability. Fred Jameson didn't have Julia's artful tongue. By the beginning of October, when Chip sent his finished script to Eden Procuro, he'd sold his feminists, his formalists, his structuralists, his post-structuralists, his Freudians, and his queers. To raise money for lunch for his parents and Denise, all he had left was his beloved cultural historians and his complete hardcover Arden Shakespeare. And because a kind of magic resided in the Shakespeare, the uniform volumes in their pale blue jackets were like an archipelago of safe retreats. He piled his Foucault and Greenblatt and Hooks and Puvy into shopping bags and sold them all for $115. He spent $60 on a haircut, some candy, a stain removal kit, and 2 drinks at the Cedar Tavern. Back in August, when he'd invited his parents, he'd hoped that Eden Procuro might have read his script and advanced him money before they arrived. But now the only accomplishment and the only gift he had to offer was a home-cooked meal. He went to an East Village deli that sold reliably excellent tortellini and crusty bread. He was envisioning a rustic and affordable Italian lunch. But the deli appeared to have gone out of business, and he didn't feel like walking 10 blocks to a bakery that he was certain had good bread. And so he wandered the East Village randomly, trudging in and out of meretricious food stores, hefting cheeses, rejecting breads, examining inferior tortellini. Finally, he abandoned the Italian idea altogether and fixed on the only other lunch he could think of, a salad of wild rice, avocado, and smoked turkey breast. The problem then was to find ripe avocados. In store after store, he found either no avocados or walnut-hard avocados. He found ripe avocados that were the size of limes and cost $3.89 apiece. He stood holding five of them and considered what to do. He put them down and picked them up and put them down and couldn't pull the trigger. He weathered a spasm of hatred of Denise for having guilted him into inviting his parents to lunch. He had the feeling that he'd never eaten anything in his life but wild rice, salad, and tortellini. So blank was his culinary imagination. Around 8 o'clock, he ended up outside the new Nightmare of Consumption, everything for a price, on Grand Street. A humidity had stolen over the sky, a sulphurous, uneasy wind from Rahway and Bayonne. The super gentry of Soho and Tribeca were streaming through the nightmare's brushed steel portals. The men came in various shapes and sizes, but all the women were slim and 36. Many were both slim and pregnant. Chip had a collar rash from his haircut and felt unready to be seen by so many perfect women. But right inside the nightmare's door, he glimpsed a box of greens marked Sorrel from Belize, 99 cents. He entered the nightmare, snagged a basket, and put one bunch of sorrel in it, 99 cents. Installed above the nightmare's coffee bar was a screen that gave running ironic tallies of today's gross receipts and today's profit and projected quarterly per-share dividend, unofficial non-binding estimate based on past quarterly performances. This information provided for entertainment purposes only. And coffee sales this station. Chip wove among strollers and cell phone antennae to the fish counter where, as in a dream, he found wild Norwegian salmon, line caught, on sale at a reasonable price. He pointed at a mid-sized fillet, and to the fishman's question, "What else?" he replied in a crisp tone, almost a smug tone, "That'll do it." The price on the beautiful paper-wrapped fillet that he was handed was $78.40. Luckily, this discovery knocked the wind out of him, otherwise he might have lodged a protest before realizing, as he did now, that the prices at the nightmare were per quarter pound. 2 years ago, 2 months ago, he would not have made a mistake like this. "Ha-ha," he said, palming the $78 fillet like a catcher's mitt. He dropped to one knee and touched his bootlaces and took the salmon right up inside his leather jacket and underneath his sweater and tucked the sweater into his pants and stood up again.
"Daddy, I want swordfish,"
a little voice behind him said. Chip took 2 steps, and the salmon, which was quite heavy, escaped from his sweater and covered his groin for one unstable moment, like a codpiece.
"Daddy, swordfish!"
Chip put his hand to his crotch. The dangling fillet felt like a cool, loaded diaper. He repositioned it against his abs and tucked in the sweater more securely, zipped his jacket to the neck, and strode purposefully toward the whatever, toward the dairy wall. Here he found a selection of French crème fraîche at prices implying transport via SST. The less unaffordable domestic crème fraîche was blocked by a man in a Yankees cap who was shouting into a cell phone while a child, apparently his, peeled back the foil tops of half-liters of French yogurt. She'd peeled back 5 or 6 already. Chip leaned to reach behind the man, but his fish belly sagged. "Excuse me," he said. Like a sleepwalker, the man on the phone shuffled aside.
"I said fuck him, fuck him, fuck that asshole. We never closed. There's no ink on the line. I'll take that asshole down another 30. You watch me."
"Honey, don't tear those. If we tear those, we have to pay for them."
"I said it is a fucking buyer's ball as of yesterday. We close on nothing till this thing bottoms out. Nothing, 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 nothing."
Chip was approaching the checkout lanes with 4 plausible items in his basket when he caught sight of a head of hair so new penny bright it could only belong to Eden Procuro, who was herself slim and 36 and hectic.
Eden's little son, Anthony, was seated on the upper level of a shopping cart with his back to a four-figure avalanche of shellfish, cheeses, meats, and caviars. Eden was leaning over Anthony and letting him pull on the taupe lapels of her Italian suit and suck on her blouse while, behind his back, she turned the pages of a script that Chip could only pray was not his own. The line-caught Norwegian salmon was soaking through its wrapping, his body heat melting the fats that had given the fillet a degree of rigidity. He wanted to escape the nightmare, but he wasn't prepared to discuss the Academy purple under the current circumstances. He veered down a frosty aisle where the gelati came in plain white cartons with small black lettering. A man in a suit was crouching beside a little girl with hair like copper in sunshine. The girl was Eden's daughter, April. The man was Eden's husband, Doug O'Brien.
"Chip Lambert, what's happening?"
Doug said. There seemed to be no ways but girly ways for Chip to hold his grocery basket while he shook Doug's square hand.
"April's picking out her treat for after dinner," Doug said.
"Three treats,"
April said. "Her three treats, right."
"What's that one?"
April said, pointing. "That is a grenadine nasturtium sorbetto, sugar bunny."
"Do I like it?"
"That I can't tell you." Doug, who was younger and shorter than Chip, so persistently claimed to be in awe of Chip's intellect, and so consistently tested free of any irony or condescension that Chip had finally accepted that Doug really did admire him. This admiration was more grueling than belittlement.
"Eden tells me you finished the script,"
Doug said, restacking some gelati that April had upset.
"Man, I am psyched. This project sounds phenomenal."
April was cradling three rhymed cartons against her corduroy jumper.
"What kind did you get?"
Chip asked her. April shrugged extremely, a beginner's shrug.
"Sugar Bunny, run those up to Mommy. I'm going to talk to Chip."
As April ran back up the aisle, Chip wondered what it would be like to father a child, to always be needed instead of always needing.
"Something I wanted to ask you," Doug said. "Do you have a second? Say somebody offered you a new personality. Would you take it? Say somebody said to you, 'I will permanently rewire your mental hardware in whatever way you want.' Would you pay to have that done?"
The salmon paper was sweat-bonded to Chip's skin and tearing open at the bottom. This was not the ideal time to be providing Doug with the intellectual companionship he seemed to crave, but Chip wanted Doug to keep thinking highly of him and encourage Eden to buy his script. He asked why Doug asked.
"A lot of crazy stuff crosses my desk," Doug said. "Especially now, with all the money coming home from overseas, all the dot-com issues, of course. We're still trying our very hardest to persuade the average American to happily engineer his own financial ruin. But the biotech is fascinating. I've been reading whole prospectuses about genetically altered squash. Apparently people in this country are eating a lot more squash than I was aware of, and squashes are prone to more diseases than you'd infer from their robust exterior. Either that or Southern Cucum Tech is seriously overvalued at 35 a share. Whatever, but Chip, this brain thing, man, it caught my eye. Bizarre fact number one is that I'm allowed to talk about it. It's all public knowledge. Is this bizarre?"
Chip was trying to keep his eyes focused on Doug in an interested manner, but his eyes were like children. They wanted to skip up and down the aisles. He was ready, basically, to jump out of his skin.
"Yeah, bizarre."
"The idea," Doug said, "is your basic gut-cerebral rehab. Leave the shell and roof, replace the walls and plumbing, design away that useless dining nook, put a modern circuit breaker in."
"Uh-huh."
"You get to keep your handsome facade," Doug said. "You still look serious and intellectual, a little Nordic on the outside, sober, bookish. But inside, you're more livable. A big family room with an entertainment console, a kitchen that's roomier and handier. You've got your in-sinkerator, your convection oven, an ice cube dispenser on the refrigerator door."
"Do I still recognize myself?" "Do you want to? Everybody else still will, at least the outside of you."
The big glowing tally for today's gross receipts paused for a moment at $444,447.41, and then went higher. "My furnishings are my personality," Chip said. "Say it's a gradual rehab. Say the workmen are very tidy. The brain's cleaned up every night when you get home from work, and nobody can bother you on the weekend, per local ordinance and the usual covenantal restrictions. The whole thing happens in stages. You grow into it. Or it grows into you, so to speak. Nobody's making you buy new furniture."
"You're asking hypothetically."
Doug raised a finger. "The only thing is, there might be some metal involved. It's possible you'd set off alarms at the airport. I'm imagining you might get some unwanted talk radio, too, on certain frequencies. Gatorade and other high electrolyte drinks might be a problem. But what do you say?"
"You're joking, right?"
"Check out the website. I'll give you the address. The implications are disturbing, but there's no stopping this powerful new technology. That could be the motto for our age, don't you think?"
That a salmon fillet was now spreading down into Chip's underpants like a wide, warm slug did seem to have everything to do with his brain and with a number of poor decisions that this brain had made. Rationally, Chip knew that Doug would let him go soon and that eventually he might even escape the nightmare of consumption and find a restaurant bathroom where he could take the fillet out and regain his full critical faculties. That there would come a moment when he was no longer standing amid pricey gelati with lukewarm fish in his pants, and that this future moment would be a moment of extraordinary relief. But for now, he still inhabited an earlier, much less pleasant moment from the vantage point of which a new brain looked like just the ticket.
"The desserts were a foot tall," Enid said, her instincts having told her that Denise didn't care about pyramids of shrimp. "It was elegant, elegant. Have you ever seen anything like that?"
"I'm sure it was very nice," Denise said.
"The driblets really do things super deluxe. I'd never seen a dessert that tall, have you?"
The subtle signs that Denise was exercising patience, the slightly deeper breaths she took, the soundless way she set her fork down on her plate and took a sip of wine and set the glass back down, were more hurtful to Enid than a violent explosion.
"I've seen tall desserts," Denise said. "Are they tremendously difficult to make?"
Denise folded her hands in her lap and exhaled slowly.
"It sounds like a great party. I'm glad you had fun."
Enid had, true enough, had fun at Dean and Trish's party, and she'd wished that Denise had been there to see for herself how elegant it was. At the same time, she was afraid that Denise would not have found the party elegant at all, that Denise would have picked apart its specialness until there was nothing left but ordinariness. Her daughter's taste was a dark spot in Enid's vision, a hole in her experience through which her own pleasures were forever threatening to leak and dissipate.
"I guess there's no accounting for tastes," she said.
"That's true," Denise said, "although some tastes are better than others."
Alfred had bent low over his plate to ensure that any salmon or haricot vert that fell from his fork would land on china. But he was listening. He said, "Enough."
"That's what everybody thinks," Enid said. "Everybody thinks their taste is the best."
"But most people are wrong," Denise said. "Everybody's entitled to their own taste," Enid said. "Everybody gets one vote in this country."
"Unfortunately."
"Enough," Alfred said to Denise. "You'll never win."
"You sound like a snob," Enid said.
"Mother, you're always telling me how much you like a good home-cooked meal. Well, that's what I like, too. I think there's a kind of Disney vulgarity in a foot-tall dessert. You are a better cook than—"
"Oh, no, no," Enid shook her head. "I'm a nothing cook."
"That's not true at all. Where do you think I—"
"Not from me," Enid interrupted. "I don't know where my children got their talents, but not from me. I'm a nothing as a cook. A big nothing."
How strangely good it felt to say this. It was like putting scalding water on a poison ivy rash.
Denise straightened her back and raised her glass. Enid, who all her life had been helpless not to observe the goings-on other people's plates, had watched Denise take a 3-bite portion of salmon, a small helping of salad, and a crust of bread. The size of each was a reproach to the size of each of Enid's. Now Denise's plate was empty, and she hadn't taken seconds of anything.
"Is that all you're going to eat?" Enid said.
"Yes, that was my lunch."
"You've lost weight."
"In fact, not."
"Well, don't lose any more,"
Enid said with the skimpy laugh with which she tried to hide large feelings. Alfred was guiding a forkful of salmon and sorrel sauce to his mouth. The food dropped off his fork and broke into violently shaped pieces.
"I think Chip did a good job with this," Enid said. "Don't you think? The salmon is very tender and good."
"Chip has always been a good cook," Denise said.
"Al, are you enjoying this? Al?"
Alfred's grip on his fork had slackened. There was a sag in his lower lip, a sullen suspicion in his eyes.
"Are you enjoying the lunch?" Enid said.
He took his left hand in his right and squeezed it. The mated hands continued their oscillation together while he stared at the sunflowers in the middle of the table. He seemed to swallow the sour set of his mouth, to choke back the paranoia.
"Chip made all this?"
he said.
"Yes."
He shook his head, as though Chip's having cooked, Chip's absence now, overwhelmed him.
"I am increasingly bothered by my affliction," he said.
"What you have is very mild," Enid said. "We just need to get the medication adjusted."
He shook his head.
"Edgepeth said it's unpredictable."
"The important thing is to keep doing things," Enid said. "To keep active, to always just go."
"No. You were not listening. Edgepeth was very careful not to promise anything."
"According to what I read..."
"I don't give a damn what your magazine article said. I am not well." "And Edgepeth admitted as much."
Denise set her wine down with a stiff, fully extended arm.
"So what do you think about Chip's new job?" Enid asked her brightly.
"His..."
"Well, at the Wall Street Journal."
Denise studied the tabletop.
"I have no opinion about it." "It's exciting, don't you think?" "I have no opinion about it." "Do you think he works there full-time?"
"No."
"I don't understand what kind of job it is."
"Mother, I know nothing about it."
"Is he still doing law?"
"You mean proofreading?"
"Yes." "So he's still at the firm?"
"He's not a lawyer, Mother."
"I know he's not a lawyer."
"Well, when you say doing law or at the firm, is that what you tell your friends?"
"I say he works at a law firm, that's all I say.
A New York City law firm."
"And it's the truth, he does work there."
"It's misleading, and you know it,"
Alfred said.
"I guess I should just never say anything."
"Just say things that are true," Denise said.
"Well, I think he should be in law," Enid said. "I think the law would be perfect for Chip. He needs the stability of a profession. He needs structure in his life. Dad always thought he'd make an excellent lawyer. I used to think doctor because he was interested in science, but Dad always saw him as a lawyer. Didn't you, Al? Didn't you think Chip could be an excellent lawyer? He's so quick with the words."
"Enid, it's too late."
"I thought maybe working for the firm he'd get interested and go back to school."
"Far too late."
"The thing is, Denise, there are so many things you can do with law. You can be a company president. You can be a judge. You can teach. You can be a journalist. There are so many directions Chip could go in."
"Chip will do what he wants to do,"
Alfred said.
"I've never understood it, but he is not going to change now."
He marched 2 blocks in the rain before he found a dial tone. At the first twin phone bank he came to, one instrument was castrated, with colored tassels at the end of its cord, and all that remained of the other was 4 bolt holes. The phone at the next intersection had chewing gum in its coin slot, and the line of its companion was completely dead. The standard way for a man in Chip's position to vent his rage was to smash the handset on the box and leave the plastic shards in the gutter, but Chip was in too much of a hurry for this. At the corner of Fifth Avenue, he tried a phone that had a dial tone but did not respond when he touched the keypad and did not return his quarter when he hung up nicely or when he picked the handset up and slammed it down. The other phone had a dial tone and took his money, but a baby bell voice claimed not to understand what he dialed and did not return the money. He tried a second time and lost his last quarter. He smiled at the SUVs crawling by in ready-to-break-bad-weather automotive postures. The doormen in this neighborhood hosed the sidewalks twice a day, and sanitation trucks with brushes like the mustaches of city cops scoured the streets three times a week. But in New York City, you never had to go far to find filth and rage. A nearby street sign seemed to read Filth Avenue. Things cellular were killing public phones, but unlike Denise, who considered cell phones the vulgar accessories of vulgar people, and unlike Gary, who not only didn't hate them but had bought one for each of his three boys, Chip hated cell phones mainly because he didn't have one. Under the scant protection of Denise's umbrella, he crossed back to a deli on University Place. Brown cardboard had been laid over the scuff rug at the door for traction, but the cardboard was soaked and trampled, its shreds resembling washed-up kelp. Headlines in wire baskets by the door reported yesterday's tanking of two more economies in South America and fresh plunges in key Far Eastern markets. Behind the cash register was a lottery poster. "It's not about winning. It's about fun." With two of the $4 in his wallet, Chip bought some of the all-natural licorice that he liked. For his third dollar, the deli clerk gave him four quarters in change. "I'll take a lucky leprechaun, too," Chip said. The three-leaf clover, wooden harp, and pot of gold that he uncovered weren't a winning or fun combination. "Is there a payphone around here that works?"
"No payphone,"
the clerk said. "I'm saying, is there one close to here that works?"
"No payphone."
The clerk reached under the counter and held up a cell phone. "This phone."
"Can I make one quick call with that?"
"Too late for broker now. Should have called yesterday. Should have by American."
The clerk laughed in a way that was the more insulting for being good-humored. But then Chip had reason to be sensitive. Since D. College had fired him, the market capitalization of publicly traded U.S. companies had increased by 35%. In these same 22 months, Chip had liquidated a retirement fund, sold a good car, worked half-time at an 80th percentile wage, and still ended up on the brink of Chapter 11. These were years in America when it was nearly impossible not to make money, years when receptionists wrote MasterCard checks to their brokers at 13.9% APR and still cleared a profit, years of buy, years of call, and Chip had missed the boat. In his bones, he knew that if he ever did sell the Academy Purple, the markets would all have peaked the week before, and any money he invested he would lose. Judging from Julia's negative response to his script, the American economy was safe for a while yet. Up the street at the Cedar Tavern, he found a working payphone. Years seemed to have passed since he'd had two drinks here the night before. He dialed Eden Procuro's office and hung up when her voicemail kicked in, but the quarter had already dropped. Directory Assistance had a residential listing for Doug O'Brien, and Doug actually answered, but he was changing a diaper. Several minutes passed before Chip was able to ask him if Eden had read the script yet.
"Phenomenal. Phenomenal-sounding project," Doug said. "I think she had it with her when she went out."
"Do you know where she went?"
"Chip, you know I can't tell people where she is, you know that."
"I think the situation qualifies as urgent."
"Please deposit 80 cents for the next 2 minutes."
"My God, a payphone," Doug said. "Is that a payphone?" Chip fed the phone his last two quarters. "I need to get the script back before she reads it. There's a correction.
This isn't about tits, is it? Eden said Julia had a problem with too many tits. I wouldn't worry about that. Generally, there's no such thing as too many. Julia's having a really intense week. Please deposit an additional 30 cents now."
"You what?" Doug said.
"For the next 2 minutes, now. Most obvious place, you, or your call will be terminated, now."
"Doug?" Chip said. "Doug, I missed that."
"We're sorry."
"Yeah, I'm here. I'm saying, why don't you—"
"Goodbye,"
the company voice said. and the phone went dead, the wasted quarters clanking in its gut. The text on its faceplate had baby bell coloration, but it read, Orphic Telecom, 3 minutes, 25 cents, each additional minute, 40 cents. The most obvious place to look for Eden was at her office in Tribeca. Chip stepped up to the bar, wondering if the new bartender, a streaky blonde who looked like she might front a kind of band that played at proms, remembered him well enough from the night before to take his driver's license as surety on a 20-buck loan. She and two unrelated drinkers were watching murky football somewhere, Nittany Lion action, brown, squiggling figures in a chalky pond. And near Chip's arm, oh, not 6 inches away, was a nest of singles, just lying there. He considered how a tacit transaction, pocketing the cash, never showing his face in here again, anonymously mailing reimbursement to the woman later, might be safer than asking for a loan, might be, indeed, the transgression that saved his sanity. He crumpled the cash into a ball and moved closer to the really rather pretty bartender, but the struggling brown, round-headed men continued to hold her gaze, and so he turned and left the tavern. In the back of a cab, watching the wet businesses drift by, he stuffed licorice into his mouth. If he couldn't get Julia back, he wanted, in the worst way, to have sex with the bartender, who looked about 39 herself. He wanted to fill his hands with her smoky hair. He imagined that she lived in a rehabbed tenement on East Fifth. He imagined that she drank a beer at bedtime and slept in faded sleeveless tops and gym shorts, that her posture was weary, her navel unassumingly pierced, her pussy like a seasoned baseball glove, her toenails painted the plainest basic red. He wanted to feel her legs across his back. He wanted to hear the story of her 40-odd years. He wondered if she really might sing rock and roll at weddings and bar mitzvahs. Through the window of the cab, he read Gap Athletic as Gal Pathetic. He read Empire Realty as Vampire Reality. He was half in love with a person he could never see again. He'd stolen $9 from a hard-working woman who enjoyed college football. Even if he went back later and reimbursed her and apologized, he would always be the man who ripped her off when her back was turned. She was gone from his life forever. He could never run his fingers through her hair, and it was not a good sign that this latest loss was making him hyperventilate, that he was too wrecked by pain to swallow more licorice. He read cross pens as cross penises. He read alterations as altercations. An optometrist's window offered heads examined. The problem was money, and the indignities of life without it. Every stroller, cell phone, Yankees cap, and SUV he saw was a torment. He wasn't covetous. He wasn't envious. But without money, he was hardly a man. How he'd changed since D. College fired him. He no longer wanted to live in a different world. He just wanted to be a man with dignity in this world. And maybe Doug was right. Maybe the breasts in his script didn't matter. But he finally understood, he finally got it, that he could simply cut the opening theoretical monologue in its entirety. He could do this correction in 10 minutes at Eaton's office. In front of her building, he gave the cabbie all 9 stolen dollars. Around the corner, a 6-trailer crew was filming on a cobbled street, Kleegs ablaze, generators tinking in the rain. Chip knew the security codes to Eden's building, and the elevator was unlocked. He prayed that Eden hadn't read the script yet. The newly corrected version in his head was the one true script, but the old opening monologue still unhappily existed on the ivory-bond paper of the copy Eden had. Through the glass outer door on the 5th floor, he saw lights in Eden's office. That his socks were soaked, and his jacket smelled like a wet cow at the seashore, and he had no way to dry his hands or hair was certainly unpleasant. But he was still enjoying not having 2 pounds of Norwegian salmon in his pants. By comparison, he felt fairly well put together. He knocked on the glass until Eden emerged from her office and peered out at him. Eden had high cheekbones and big, watery blue eyes and thin, translucent skin. Any extra calories she ate at lunch in L.A. or drank as martinis in Manhattan got burned on her home treadmill or at her private swim club or in the general madness of being Eden Procuro. She was ordinarily electric and flaming, a bundle of hot copper wire. But her expression now, as she approached the door, was tentative or flustered. She kept looking back at her office. Chip gestured that he wanted in. "She's not here," Eden said through the glass. Chip gestured again. Eden opened the door and put her hand on her heart. "Chip, I'm so sorry about you and Julia. I'm looking for my script. Have you read it?"
"I..." "Very hastily. I need to read it again. Need to take some notes."
Eden made a scribbling motion near her temple and laughed.
"That opening monologue," Chip said, "I've cut it." "Oh, good. I love a willingness to cut. Love it." She looked back at her office. "Do you think, though, that without the monologue..." "Chip, do you need money?"
Eden smiled up at him with such odd, merry frankness that he felt as if he'd caught her drunk or with her pants down.
"Well, I'm not flat broke," he said. "No, no, of course, but still."
"Why?"
"And how are you with the web?" she said. "Do you know any Java, HTML?"
"God, no."
"Well, just come back to my office for a second, do you mind? Come on back."
Chip followed Eden past Julia's desk, where the only visible Julian artifact was a stuffed toy frog on the computer monitor.
"Now that you two have broken up," Eden said, "there's really no reason you can't..."
"Eden, it's not a breakup."
"No, no, trust me, it's over," Eden said. "It is absolutely over. And I'm thinking you might enjoy a little change of scenery, so you can start getting over it."
"Eden, listen, Julia and I are having a momentary..."
"No, Chip, sorry, not momentary, permanent."
Eden laughed again.
"Julia may not be blunt, but I am, and so, when I think about it, there's really no reason for you not to meet." She led Chip into her office. "Gitanas? Incredible stroke of luck here. I have, here, the perfect man for the job."
Reclining in a chair by Eden's desk was a man about Chip's age in a red-ribbed leather jacket and tight white jeans. His face was broad and baby-cheeked, his hair a sculpted blonde shell. Eden was practically climaxing with enthusiasm.
"Here I've been racking my brain, Gitanas. I can't think of anyone to help you, and probably the best qualified man in New York City is knocking at the door. Chip Lambert, you know my assistant Julia?"
She winked at Chip.
"Well, this is Julia's husband, Gitanas Misevicius."